for those who don't know, I'd like to introduce Ajahn Suchito, who's going to be with us for the next 3 days, from today to Thursday afternoon. Ajahn Suchito is the abbot of Chithurst Monastery in England, and he's been a monk for 36 years.
So,
further ado, I hand the floor over to Ajahn Suchito.
What more is there to say, really? So, give a little talk. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Buddhang dhammang sanghang nasami. Just arrived at Buddhadharma this afternoon, so just taking it in. Obviously, I don't know you personally, but not exactly you need to know or was helpful. So I'll just give a few general comments, and then if there are any questions or things you'd like to ask about, you can do that later and any time, as long as I'm here. Happy to have a questions and answers session or whatever is helpful for your practice. That's what I've come for. So please feel free to make use of my time while I'm here. So I come to various monasteries and Dhamma places, but they all have slightly different qualities and features to them, but different venues, different countries. But it's fundamentally certain things become apparent about these places. They have a certain simplicity, focus. Essentially, it's what we don't need, we leave it outside. What we do need, we make full use of. So here we leave outside other concerns, accoutrements, appurtenances, duties, responsibilities. There's a simplification. And then what we do have here, we have space, we have time, we have precepts, we have meditation, we have a chance to focus on the breathing or the heart or whatever our meditation topic is, and make very full use of that. So it's always this sense of channeling and gathering one's energy, one's attention, one's mental perspectives into something that's conducive. It's always this process. The fourfold efforts really come down to putting aside what we don't need, keeping it aside, and picking up what's good, keeping it there, sustaining it. That's the kind of pivot, the central feature of Dhamma practice. And the Buddha didn't always give specific fine details on what was to be put aside and what was to be picked up, but often would say you put aside whatever causes unskillful Dhammas to arise, you put that aside. Whatever causes skillful Dhammas to arise, you pick it up. Whether it's in terms of speech or bodily action, and of course in terms of mental cultivation. So just this kind of continual assessment, recognizing what's skillful, takes a bit of time. Recognizing what's unskillful takes a bit of time. But then as we get more clear how our minds work and what's best for us, what's conducive, then we've got some things to work upon. And essentially, when you're working on things that are conducive, meditation practice, self-discipline, and so forth. As you get firm about that, you establish that, you make that a firm refuge, you sustain it, you deepen it, and then that takes you to a clearer perspective. You can see even more clearly, this I don't need to do, this I don't need to think about, this I don't need to keep bearing in mind, I can drop that. You know. Thoughts of the future, thoughts of the past, doesn't do me any good. Not helpful right now, I can drop that. Thoughts about myself, thoughts about other people, perceptions of myself and perceptions of other people, how useful is that? To what purpose is that? Put that aside. So we just focus on what's happening in the mind in the here and now. And picking it up, looking at what's skillful, what's supportive. So it's this continual application of our focusing power, our awareness, our ability to be receptive, and mindfulness and full awareness. Using the requisites, you know, like physical requisites. Recognize that if you have requisites you don't need, we tend to become an encumbrance because they distract us, or we hang on to them, or we try to store them up, or we're worried about losing them. So actually we're doing ourselves a favor by simplifying our requisites, so it's less to have to worry about, think about, you know, compare and so forth. And then what requisites you do have, make use of them for the purpose, like food, shelter, medicines, clothing and so forth. So it's a whole cultivation of life. You know, monastery provides an occasion, a Dhamma place provides an occasion for that introspection, that reflection and ongoing occurrence, and then when you recurrence of mental attention, so that the advantage is once you recognize that, even when you leave the place, you've established some benchmarks, some things. Oh yeah, I don't really need that. This is really useful. You know, this practice is useful, this concern, this topic isn't useful. So you get some way you're continually steering your life in a ongoing direction. Because if we don't steer our life, then what tends to happen is our life gets steered for us by pressures of society, by pressures of the world. Find ourselves just swept along by time, place, people, praise, blame, gain, loss, happiness, unhappiness, and so forth. It's kind of like a fish caught in a current, moving fast but really just swept along. So it's very important to use the time to establish your own sense of restraint, discipline, what you really want to bring your energy into, making good use of it, and always checking out the results. Now, one of the Buddha taught in many ways, variety of themes, but you can pick up any little cluster of them and ponder them, turn them over. And one particular set he taught was the four requisites for stream entry. So stream entry means you've got a very firm foundation and practice. You've begun to realize where conditions drop away. You get some recognition of ceasing of conditions, realization of something, you know, beyond that, beyond the conditioned realm. So this is must be our principal aim, to establish something where we're not falling back all the time. And stream entry goes against the stream of Dhamma, whereby we're not following the stream of the world. You know, so then you're not going to be just going caught up in things anymore. So prerequisites for stream entry are association with, it's called the Sapurisa, people of integrity, people who are living in terms of Dhamma, people who are integrating their internal, their Dhamma practice with their life. So they're living in a whole way, they don't have two faces, they only have one. they're simplifying, so they're trying to live fully the integrity according to understanding, both internally in their own body, in their own hearts, and externally in terms of their speech and actions. You could say living according to Dhamma Vinaya. Vinaya, Dhamma tends to deal with the, you might say, the internal dimension, and Vinaya deals with the external dimension. Vinaya means training oneself in terms of speech and action. Sapurisa, just to associate with such people, because basically although we can read a lot and learn from books, our most fundamental learning is from other human beings, because we're naturally receptive, attentive, we're naturally empathic. So whether other people behave, we tend to see that, model that, feel that. Perhaps we don't even have words for it, but we find ourselves calmed or encouraged or uplifted or inspired by other people, or to the contrary. So when you associate with a sapurisa, with people of integrity, quite naturally, you just relax with it, you find yourself beginning to pick up some of the balance or the measuredness or the composure or the gentleness that such beings are manifesting. So this was always the way in which for people who are complete newcomers would gain inspiration, just by seeing an advanced practitioner walking around like an arahant monk, or even just a well-practiced monk, because they'd notice, hey, these people, their faces are bright, they're serene, they're quite composed, they're collected, they're not hanging on to the future or the past, they're living just on what arises in the present, and they look radiant, often living very simply on bales of straw and just eating one meal a day from scraps of food. How come? You know, what's happening here? So, you know, even before any verbal teachings occur, just by meeting people who are deeply practiced, or in accordance with Dhamma, people who have seen and practiced and know what they don't need, and put it aside and develop what they do need, we begin to recognize there is this possibility that we as human beings can all tune into. We can all do the same thing. We all have bodies, we all have physical needs, we all have minds, we all have pleasure, pain, friends, relatives, so forth, minds that can think, and so on, and that somehow within this very human form there's a possibility for coming out of agitation, anxiety, sadness, depression, and so forth. So just seeing that, recognizing that, is a continual source of inspiration. So when you're in a place of Dhamma practice, just beginning to keep your eyes open, notice the themes, the way that the practitioners live, the teachers or the people who are deeply committed, how they live. Mm-hmm. What's that about? How can I pick up something from that? So someone who's really interested is looking around, trying to get the message from whatever they can see. You look at things in nature, like the trees, they just have what they need. You know, they're rooted in the ground and a bit of water and sunshine, and they're growing fine. It's human beings who often find themselves completely out of balance because they're just cluttered up with things that are not necessary, sometimes deeply injurious, and perhaps not sending their roots down into what is sustaining and nourishing. As human beings, we have this capacity to completely miss the point, or the capacity to deeply connect to it. So just looking at what models do we see that give us that sense of firmness and purpose externally. And another important support for practice is one's own wise reflection. Yonisomanasikara, wise attention. Yonisomanasikara means something like yoniso. Yoni is the source or the origin. Manasikara is attention, or the movement of the thinking mind as it attends to things. So we're starting to use the attention and the thinking mind in a way that instead of spinning out, takes us back to the root of things, takes us into the source of things, essentially takes us into the source of where our own minds, our own thoughts are coming from. Now, if you notice, the way that the mind can work is in terms of what we call papancha, or proliferation, making a fist of everything, making a, literally means something like a fiving, papancha. So it's a multiplicity, it's multiplying everything. So what we tend to do is think of one thing, it reminds us of something else, and then we speculate how it should be. We think about whether we want it, whether we don't want it, how it could be, how it should be, what other people think. And it's just this endless complication. How am I? What will I be? What could I be? Having been, what will I be? What will it be in the future? What was in the past? What was my previous life? What is my next life? And so on. And it just gets really complicated. But with wise attention, we start to look into what's the mind doing. So you're turning your attention to the very functioning of the mind in the present moment. What's the source of this thought? Is it coming from agitation? Is it coming from inspiration? What's the source of this mood? Is it coming from ill will? Or is it coming from benevolence? So we start to penetrate to the roots of what's happening in our own minds in the here and now. This is called appropriate or deep attention. So you start to question your own mind. Where's this coming from? And this is very important because the mind can create huge smoke screens, huge constructions of thought and possibility, rights and wrongs, shoulds and shouldn'ts, evolve complex metaphysical systems, and somehow miss the point that actually there's something very simple going on that we can attend to. Just is our mind coming from ill will or goodwill? Is it coming from a skillful state or an unskillful state? So just carrying that along in a day, when a thought arises in my mind, when an inclination arises in my mind, what is supporting it? Is it supported by restlessness or by calm? Is it supported by goodwill or ill will? Is it supported by faith or cynicism? Is it supported by, you know, just noticing whether it's skillful factors or unskillful factors that support the mind, this very mental inclination. So then you've got something you can, you know, you can teach yourself. And if you're not certain whether the thing is skillful or not, just witness it, watch it, attend to it, and see whether it takes you to a happier place, a calmer place, a place of brightness, or it takes you to some tangled up place. Just notice the effects it has on your mind. This is the way we're really putting our own mind into the laboratory and checking out what are the results of my thoughts and actions. Does it lead to complexity, tangling, entanglement? Does it lead to contentment? Does it lead to discontent? Does it lead to rousing up energy, or does it lead to indolence, and so forth? And just starting to get a handle on what the mind is doing. So this process is something we can go on kind of with us all day, whether we're sitting, standing, meditating, eating, thinking, reading, talking, whatever we're doing. So it's a much wider form of cultivation than just purely sitting meditation. Obviously, it's something that carries into sitting meditation, but it goes up. It's a much broader form of cultivation. So when you're practicing that in sitting meditation, you start to recognize what particular, you know, system or technique or really encourages my mind. What is it that hinders it? What makes it strained? It's trying to experience something I don't experience. Whether my mind is obsessed or concerned with attaining something that I haven't, it's just speculative thought. Is my mind just fully deepening into one out-breath or one in-breath? Or is it trying to get to somewhere that I've something I've read in a book? What is skillful? Which leads to the sense of deepening, calming, clearing, simplifying, which leads to complexity, anxiety, speculation, and so forth. So, you know, more or less any meditation system you use, the systems are, there's quite a few of them, but probably most important is the one is to get this right attitude and using any meditation system with appropriate deep attention. So you can see where you're coming from, what the results are, and so forth. This is an important factor for stream entry. Third factor is hearing the true Dhamma, giving attention to true Dhamma, could be even reading the true Dhamma, but hearing the true Dhamma, giving attention to the true Dhamma. What is the true Dhamma? So, of course, we can get into scriptural analysis, which is the authentic text, which is the right lineage, the right tradition, and so forth. But for simplicity's sake, I offer a way of considering what the very word Dhamma means. And Dhamma is an ancient Indian word, and it means something like the law, the order, the natural order of the cosmos, the way that things come into harmony, the way things are held in balance, the proper norm. So when we try to find one word to translate Dhamma, generally we don't translate it because it's difficult to catch it in English. It's sometimes translated as the law, the norm, the way things are, or sometimes even nature. You know, that which is in order, like the way that nature is in order. You know, so it's a sense of order. So it's not particularly one thing, but it's an orderliness. So when we look at nature, for example, there are trees and animals and rain and soil and climate and so forth, yet it all blends together to keep life going. So it has its own order. Things pass, things die, things eat other things, and yet it somehow hangs together as a self-sustaining system. Now the Buddha generally, when he approached some of these old Vedic terms, he turned them so that what was applied to a cosmic principle or to divinities, he turned it round to apply it to the mind. He internalized the cosmos. You know, he turned some of this cosmic law into the law of the mind. So what is it that brings the mind into balance, into orderliness, into freeing itself from suffering? Suffering, the stress of imbalance, the attachments, the unskillfulness, the proliferations that throw the mind into spins, into stress. So essentially, hearing the true Dhamma is hearing that or attending to that which brings the mind into a natural balance, where it's not creating stress. And just to recognize that this is possible. You know, minds don't have to be in stress and in suffering and in under pressure, under demand. So we listen to that which helps us do that. Of course, there are many different teachings, but you just pick up one thing and you maybe just dwell upon it, bear it in mind, reflect upon it, take it in till you get the results of it helping to bring your mind into order. Often these places, many forest monasteries are specifically established in forests because nature has its order and it has its effect. We sense a sense of simplicity, directness, earthiness, naturalness. It's not speedy, it's not pressurized, it's not consumerism, it's not antagonism, it's just naturalness. And that, tuning into that, is one of the basic assets that one can appreciate and benefit from in living in these places. You start to see the law of change, the law of passing, You start to see the way that things in the planet cooperate with each other, the whole ecosystems of life forces and life forms that support each other and cooperate with each other and feed each other and nourish each other and so forth. So this is what it's about. It's a sense of natural orderliness. What is it that helps to remind me of that? Is it things like, you realize that in the Buddha's teaching, all of the Dhamma that you hear is always presented in clusters, like the Four Noble Truths, the Three Characteristics, the Eightfold Path, the Seven Enlightenment Factors, the Four Indriya, the Five Indriya, the Five Bala, the Four Efforts. So it's never one thing, it's always a mixture, a balancing of several factors together. So you can't say something like, oh, the practice is just be mindful. No, the practice isn't just be mindful. The practice of mindfulness is always accompanied by factors such as sampajanya, full awareness, atapi, vigor, right view, right effort, and it's always seen as part of a cluster of factors. This helps to remind us that really Dhamma practice is always a blending of a range of mental factors. It's bringing things into harmony, how things, any skillful factor supports others. It's the coming together of many skillful factors that it gives the mind true balance. So we've got to look at that to remember things such as, you know, the indriyas, faith or confidence has to be balanced with discernment, so we're not placing our faith in the wrong direction. Calm, samadhi has to be balanced with energy so we don't get indolent. With too much energy we get restless, so you're balancing that out. And mindfulness is just the ability to bear things in mind, to see, so that we really can see the results of our practice. So we listen to things like that. And similarly, the fourth factor of stream entry is when practice is in accordance with that Dhamma. So we hear the true Dhamma, we practice in accordance with the Dhamma. We practice in accordance with what brings our mind into a sense of harmony, unity, whereby the unnecessary proliferations and accumulations of our life start to get cleaned away. We come to a simplicity and a unity of mind. In this unity of mind, certain fundamental hindrances and fetters are put aside. One of the things you can notice and bear in mind is there are four particular trajectories that I've noticed the mind goes into that are signs of it losing its harmony, losing its balance. One is when we get caught up in the past. So when you get into thinking about the past, is always when it's associated with regret or with nostalgia, just absorbing into the past. So when your mind starts thinking, oh, it was like that, how good it was, or it was like that, how terrible things I did, it was like that, I was so foolish, it was like that, it was so wonderful, now I haven't got it anymore. You realize, just, you know, bring your mind drifts off into the past, then it's always accompanied by some proliferation. That's the mind starts activating itself. Same thing in the future. True practitioner recognizes that they have no future. It's always good to keep this little motto in mind. True practitioner has no future. Because it's true, nobody has a future. All we have is a present, and the present keeps changing. It changes in accordance with circumstances and conditions, both internally generated and externally generated. There's only the present, but the present isn't fixed, it keeps changing. But the mind operates in terms of, if I do that, well, maybe I'll get one of those. And how long will it be before I get that? How long do I have to practice before I get that realization? When will I get to this state? I'm never going to get to that state. It's been too long. I'm too old. It works like that. So immediately, when you start to go into the future, there's either impatience or a sense of anticipation or expectation, feeling you don't have enough time, or whatever, things are moving too slowly. So what is your mind doing then? So when we use wise reflection, we look into that sense of the future and say, what's this depending on? Restlessness or impatience, anxiety, expectation or something like that. This isn't practice in accordance with Dhamma. This is practice in accordance with proliferation. Then if we have another two places where the mind goes off is when we practice in accordance with self. I am this, I'm this kind of person, I'm not that kind of person, I'm like this, I'm like that. I'm too old, I'm too young. I'm only a lay person, I'm a monk. Women can't do this, only men. I can't do this because I'm a lazy person. I can't do that because I'm a busy person. I'm the kind of person who has too much bad karma to practice. I'm the kind of person who has to spend 5 lifetimes because I've got all this stuff to pay off. What the weight that we carry on in being a person. So you say, what good is that doing? Wouldn't it be better just to be a mind in the present moment rather than being a person in the past? Moving towards the future, which is more in accordance with true Dhamma practice. We're carrying some identity, it's like we're already unbalancing ourselves, unbalancing the mind, putting a burden on the mind. So very often when we get these experiences of ourself, a very fundamental one for many people is a feeling of not good enough. It comes along with it. Not quite worthy, not quite pure enough, not good enough general mood. So if we're not good enough, how can we ever practice? And what would it be like to be good enough? Who's good enough? And this is a particular habit that's born in of the world, because the general process of the world is to keep people running towards some goal or some ideal of how they could be better, how they would be happy. If you just got one of these, you'd be happy. In 5 years' time, if you work hard enough, you'll be okay. If you get a PhD university education, you'll be good enough. If you get $50,000 a year for this, you'll be good enough. But you won't, because when you get that, you think of the next thing that could be better, and somebody's got it better. So is anybody ever good enough in the world? Doesn't seem to happen, because the very way of assessing oneself is already wrong. As soon as you bring that sense of self in, it's already wrong. So we use wise reflection instead of following that sense of self. Is it what is there goodwill in the mind now? Is there contentment in the mind now? Is there harmlessness in the mind now? Is there letting go in the mind now? This is good enough. And if it's not there, then we can put aside what's not appropriate. But it's basically, you can't have a self that's good enough, because the very sense of self is always caught up with attachment and desire. So it just can't be good enough. It's like a construction of the mind that is based upon a feeling of not enough. That's what tanha means, bhava tanha, the craving to be something. Vibhava tanha, the craving to get rid of things about oneself. So you can't have a self that's good enough. So it's best not to practice from that place. But you do have a mind. Yeah. And then what you can see, this is unskillful, we put it aside. This is skillful, we pick it up. Then the next moment something unskillful arises, you put it aside. Yeah. And that's good enough. That's how you practice. You can't practice being totally pure and non-attached. You've got to start from where you are, work with that, and start to recognize and do the practice. The other way we often, the mind goes astray, is when it conceives of other people. He's wonderful. She's marvelous. She's better than I am. He's stronger than I am. He's wiser than I am. She's friendlier than I am. She's happier than I am. Or she's not as happy as I am. She's stupider. She's wiser. She's more stupid. She's this, that, or the other. And again, we're just losing the point of what's really happening in the mind when we experience other people in terms of our measuring mind, our conceits, our opinions, our views. And it's amazing how, you know, when you realize that your mind is not clairvoyant and it's not telepathic and it's not all-seeing, it's not omniscient, and yet pretty quickly you can start to feel you've got to know somebody else. When you don't really even know one's own mind, one can still form a strong opinion about somebody else as being this, that, or the other, and comparing and contrasting. But you don't know anybody else. You know, we can have opinions about other people. We can receive, we can sense, and we can sense the effects other people have on us. So when you practice with people of integrity, you can sense this person's presence has got a calming, inspiring quality. That's all I need to know, because that's what I pick up and I can make use of. I don't really have to project a whole lot of stuff onto them. So whenever you practice, you've got to keep recognizing these places where the mind gets stuck. It's so easy, particularly in Buddhist practice, to always feel intimidated by reading the Buddha, the Arahants. You think, oh, I can't do that. Or you read some teacher talking about his practice, you think, I can't do that. Yeah. So this is when we use the sense of another person unskillfully. But if you read the practice, you think, that's inspiring, that's interesting, that's encouraging, I can at least go in that direction, then this is using the example of another person wisely. So you've got to check when this sense of self, other, arises. What's necessary, you bring up, you sustain. What's unnecessary, you put aside. That's the theme of the practice. So I'll just conclude the talk here. So just to kind of, you know, present a few thoughts for your reflection. And again, anything that's been said here that's been useful, bear it in mind. Anything said here that's not useful, just put it aside. Anyway. Anyone have any questions? Would you like to?
Beginning of the talk, you mentioned that using the breath as the object and the heart as the object. And can you talk more about using the heart as the object of meditation? Mm-hmm.
Well, heart is one way of referring to citta, often translated as mind, but sometimes, if you have to choose one word or the other, mind or heart, sometimes mind seems too cerebral, and maybe heart seems too emotional, but perhaps heart might be a bit closer in English to what's meant by citta. So then you can practice just contemplating citta, contemplating the heart, bearing that in mind, seeing what it's affected by, what's skillful, so you just contemplate what's arising in your mind, in your heart and mind. So, but for that, by and large, most people need to steady their citta in the body, in the bodily presence, because that gives it a certain anchorage, a certain mooring, a certain calming. So we bring our citta into the body, into the sense of a calm, steady presence, and then you begin to contemplate whatever thoughts arise, or emotions arise, or psychological factors arise, as this is the mind affected by what? Worry, affected by compassion, affected by irritation, affected by calm. This is the mind doing what minds do. So that itself is already a meditation practice. And of course you can deliberately bring into your mind an object, such a practice such as metta, loving kindness, just sustaining a sense of goodwill or non-aversion. You start to tune into that particular empathic love, well-being, benevolence, goodwill towards yourself and towards others, and just sustain that. And you can invite memories of other people into that sphere of goodwill and start to develop forgiveness or appreciation or gratitude or compassion through that practice. Well, in fact, what you do is you cultivate almost dharma tanha. Exactly, dharma tanha, the dharma chanda it's called, which means because it's so difficult to, you know, it's not just a swing between bhava and vibhava, you know, which means something like eternalism or sustaining yourself in the future, or craving towards the future, or vibhava tanha, trying to eliminate things. So essentially, you know, the mind just sometimes doesn't know anything other than those particular polarities. So you almost need to give it another polarity, which is, say, dharma. So we look at things like right effort, right intention, right speech, and you get a certain passion. Can I, you know, bring up right thought? Can I bring up right speech? Can I bring up right livelihood? And, you know, precepts, so forth. So you get keen and enthusiastic to do that, even though there may be some sense of passion or chanda, even a bit of self-view involved in it. Still, you've got to start somewhere. So the first stage is to make your apparent self at least a good one, you know, a steady one, and then you can begin to see what you don't need in that, which is the attachment and the hanging on. But first of all, we have to really put some effort into establishing standards that the mind can be guided by. You know, and it comes down to also things like reflect-wise reflection, using this a lot, particularly in the consumer world, which is always saying, you've got to have this, you've got to have that. And you think, no, you don't. You know, and the speed of it. You've got to rush, you've got to hurry. Well, generally, by and large, the message has to be less, because the most important thing that you need, that we all need, and probably very much need to deliberately cultivate in the lay life in the world is you need time. You need space, and those are the things that are basically taken away from you, filled up with occupations and preoccupations. So you have to have some sense of discipline, of definitely cutting things off, because the world never ends. It doesn't say, okay, that's enough for today now, you know. It says, oh, a bit more of this, and remember this, and plan this, and forget one of that, and get one of those, and think about this, and so forth. It doesn't let you off the hook. You've got to pull yourself off the hook by very, you know, determined, just chop it off, because it's like that never stops. You don't stop it. You know, I remember when I first went to a monastery, and then I thought pretty soon I could recognize, my father was something like 60 years old. He left school when he was 15, been working 45 years, and there was no end to it. No end to it. Just going on and on and on. And with the responsibilities and everything you buy, you've got to maintain, you know, you've got to sustain it, improve it, get a new one, and so on and so on and so on. So it's just, you end up living in order to, you know, do what? How happy does it make you? A little bit happy sometimes, but then so much stress, so much pressure, so that the mind gets under the stress and pressure, the mind doesn't function properly. Then once we lose that clarity of mind, well, it's dangerous to lose clarity, to lose balance in the mind, because this is the only thing we got. The rest of it's going to go, you know. The rest of it's going to go. Body's going to go, the money's going to go, the house is going to fall down, and so on. You know, I was seeing some people who spent their life, built, you know, worked, started off poor, felt they had to work hard, get their savings, got a whole load of savings, and then what they invested in went belly up, they lost the whole lot. You know, thought, I'll have a nest egg when I retire. But actually what happened was, after 50 years, the company, the thing they'd invested in went bankrupt. So they lost the whole lot. Yeah? You know, so what's really secure? What's really there? What you'd really have? What you have is the mind. You know? And so that's the important thing to keep going back to. The rest of it's just things we borrow for a while. If it doesn't support our mind, it tends to drag it down. So you've got to start looking at, you know, cutting off things so you can create the time. A little bit of time, it's just half an hour. Time and space to really check things out, find balance, calm the mind, clarify the mind. And so that's the eagerness for Dhamma. Is when you're eager for it, you're prepared to make efforts to change, moderate your lifestyle to make it more fully integrated into how you're living.
What's a skillful way to deal with like karma, raga, in a calm sort of way?
Well, sense passion. Reflect on it. Sense passion is always concerned with what I could experience if I had one of those. You know, in the sense of, well, if I had that, I'd be feeling, you know, ecstatic, great, wonderful. But the very feeling, that very pull itself is unpleasant. You know, the raga itself is an agitation in the mind. So you start to see how worthwhile are the objects of the senses. Obviously there's some pleasure in them, otherwise we wouldn't pursue them at all. But the pleasure is like a burst, a sudden hit of pleasure, then you've got to have some more. It's like an itch that you scratch. As you scratch it, you get a sort of temporary relief. Oh, that was really good. And then it starts to throb again. You've got to scratch it some more. So the Buddha sometimes likened it to a leper with sores. And when he cauterizes his sores, for a moment he gets some relief. But then, of course, they flare up again. You know? So it's like you want to, you know, see the shortcomings of sense pleasures. Not they don't have any pleasure, but how brief it is. And how, when the mind is continually fed that as a source of pleasure, it keeps looking in that direction. So the more that you associate the only source of pleasure as being senses, and that the mind gets that message, it's always turning that way. And generally what occurs in terms of Dhamma practice is that you've got to find pleasure in your meditation. Buddha said you become someone who fashions their own pleasure internally through calm, through qualities such as compassion or kindness is a pleasant experience, calm is a pleasant experience, self-respect is a pleasant experience, concern for the welfare of others is a pleasant experience. These are mental happiness, he said, that you should look for and direct yourself towards. Then you're starting to see, and actually these are not pleasures that give you a sudden hit and then die away, leaving you unsatisfied. They're long-term pleasures that build up to a sense of self-respect and self-esteem and happiness and contentment. There's generally a turning point because after a little while, Dhamma practice is pretty boring. One might start off quite enthusiastic about it and learning new things. That may go on for a while, but sooner or later it gets boring. It gets flat, it gets dull, it gets the same old thing, breathing in, breathing out, so what? Walking up and down, so what? Other talk, so what? You know? And it's like, this is the point where the mind is ceasing to get the inspiration from the surface of things. You know? So then what you need to do is strengthen your attention. You know, put more effort into it. It's like then you've really got to penetrate to experience things like calm, joy, piti. Put effort into it. Then you're going to get a source of pleasure that's long-lasting and associated with skillful mental factors such as energy, focus, avoidance of greed and hatred. When you start to get that pleasure and it becomes established, then it weans you of the other kind of pleasure. It's impossible to let go of sense pleasure unless you've got something else to replace it. The mind just won't do it. You know, we're very simple creatures in some ways. We just follow pleasure and avoid pain. You know, that's what it's tuned in to do. So you've got to substitute the pleasure of the senses for the pleasure of Dhamma. And make the Dhamma something that you can derive pleasure from. And then then it's a more sustaining one that you feel a sense of self-respect with. So you become more attuned to that. It's not that, you know, in a way it's not that noble. You know, we just look at what's going to give me a better result. And, the truth of the matter is, it's not about being puritanical. The truth of the matter is that there is a stronger and a better result of happiness that you can get from Dhamma than you can get from the senses. And you just, you've often got to challenge the mind, because the mind gets to a certain point and it doesn't want to bother anymore. And you've got to kind of keep working it, putting attention to what you're doing. Full attention to what you're doing. And you start to take initiative, sense what's the happiness, the pleasure that comes from just being in the present moment and awake and attuned to things. Makes your mind fresh and bright. Serving other people, doing skillful deeds gives you a feeling of, that was kindness, contentment, self-respect. This is how the pleasure begins. Pleasure begins really with things like sila. And then it becomes samadhi, and then it becomes panya. But you start off with just things like skillful conduct and seeing, it was really nice to help so-and-so. It's really good. I didn't curse somebody, I restrained myself. It felt good.
Yeah. I had an extension to the cushion. Very constantly, being trying to be in the present moment, sometimes it comes to a stage where my mind gets bored with it, constantly observing what presently I'm doing, and then my mind started to analyze the Dhamma, things that's going through in my heart. That's the cause of this, it's the cause of that, and constantly having that conversation inside. How do you manage that?
How do you manage the...
So it's rather than being constantly mindful about what I'm doing physically, the mind starts to have a conversation analyzing things.
The mind is analyzing.
Yeah, so for example, a thought comes to my mind and I try to think out how did that originate, what is the cause of that, for example, it could be fear, things like that then comes into mind, so the mind is constantly having a chatter.
Yeah. Well, the thinking is quite a clumsy way of knowing things. There are finer ways of knowing things. There are subtler and more astute ways of knowing things than through thinking. So, if you try to, figure out how to walk, it's too complicated to really know which muscle to operate. There are a whole set of muscles that coordinate, but when the body knows walking, it knows walking without thinking about it. You try to figure out how to walk, you probably fall over. So the more that you sort of develop bodily awareness, then you begin to wean the mind of dependence on thought. So there are actually different kinds of intelligence. There's the body intelligence, there's the heart intelligence, and then there's the thought intelligence. And thought intelligence is the one that comes up with the concepts. And naturally, this is the intelligence that mostly we're conditioned into treating with great respect, because it's all the books, all the learning, is in terms of words and thoughts. But when you apply them, you realize that in direct practice you find that they are busy, they're cluttered, they tire you out, and they don't really produce an effect of calming or contentment. They just lead to another thought. So this is why we start to practice things like deepening our attention to the body, feeling in the body, walking, sitting, breathing in and out. Now when you get really attuned to your body, just notice the effects in your body of something like happiness, or something like sadness, or anxiety, or irritation, you'll notice a particular change. Like, you know, when I'm angry, I don't feel relaxed, I generally feel tense and tight. When I'm happy, I feel quite expansive, in bodily sense. So you begin to turn towards the body for giving you understanding rather than your thinking. This is a useful thing to practice with. Now you might notice that when you're thinking a lot, you've got a lot of energy coming up into your face, perhaps your eyes feel tense and tight, maybe even the corners of your mouth tighten up because you're thinking things over, and you get a lot coming up in your forehead. So when you have a lot of thinking, just start to relax your face, your eyes, your forehead, your throat, and you'll find the thinking quietens down. And then by that you can then sense what you need to know. What you need to know is really rather simple. You just need to know skillful, unskillful, stress, non-stress. So, you know, and you can sense that with your body. And the sensing it in your body also means you don't just know it, but also you experience the quality of calm and non-agitation. Thinking tends towards agitation. So when you find a lot of internal chatter, it's best just to drop, you know, just notice what's happening in your body when you have internal chatter. Bring yourself to a long out-breath. Breathe all the way out and then pause at the end of the out-breath. Slow it right down. So you turn your thinking mind into your body and use the body to slow it down and check it. So the kind of analysis we get with is there a skillful mind state or an unskillful mind state? You can know that in terms of your body, and you can know it in terms of whether the heart feels contracted, busy, settled, calm. That's all, so you can look at either the body sense or the heart sense. And then all you really need to know is this suffering, stressful, non-suffering, non-stressful? Is this skillful, unskillful? And so that's all you need to know, essentially. You know, once you've got that basic thing, then that's the basic requirement. You may by doing that, you may suddenly see a whole lot more. That's interesting. I begin to see that, but that comes by itself. The principal understanding we have is of suffering and cessation of suffering, or stopping suffering. When that occurs, then by itself you see a lot of other things, a lot of other patterns, and that's the way it acts. But the first thing is to just pull the plug on suffering, stress, agitation, restlessness, doubt. You know, and that's what you can sense, those effects quite immediately in your heart and in your body. So you emphasize those forms of intelligence and quieten or slow or even just direct your thinking intelligence. All it has to do is to say what's happening. All it has to do is be used as a pointer. What's happening in my body now? Where is my breath now? That's all you want to use your thinking for, just to turn your attention, not to evolve a whole conceptual explanation of what's going on. Satipanno bhagavato sāvaka-saṅgho.